Hello, everybody, and welcome to On Science, the weekly podcast from the Science Desk at NPR. I'm Adam Cole, one of the interns here. This week, our stories come from the crossroads of science and policy. We'll hear about a fierce struggle within the organic farming movement over a contentious question: does livestock raised on genetically engineered feed deserve the organic label? America is looking for friendlier places to get fuel, and Congress has to decide how much the country should spend to protect the environment. Then, at the end of the show, one small creature navigates the open ocean using the Earth's magnetic field. First up, a familiar story. There's turmoil in the Middle East and an increase in worldwide demand for oil, and that means U.S. gas prices are rising. As NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, this scenario has put the subject of energy independence back into the political spotlight.
When oil oligarchies teeter, people who buy oil get jittery and bid up the price. But demand for oil is up, too. Places like China and Brazil are growing, and the U.S. economy is shaking off its recession. Richard Newell, who heads the government's Energy Information Administration, says it's a 1-2 punch to the oil market.
Even before the last several weeks, we had seen increases in oil prices, which have moved into and affected increases in gasoline prices.
Pumping more oil out of the ground could lower prices, but who's got extra oil?
Spare production capacity for crude oil is located in OPEC countries, predominantly in Saudi Arabia.
Once again, OPEC and a Middle Eastern kingdom have their hands on the spigot. So American politicians and the oil industry are renewing their campaign to drill more here. Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska is among the first to chime in. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, known as ANWR, is her solution. It sits on a big pool of oil, but its environmental value has kept it from being developed.
Our resolve to produce energy from ANWR remains as strong as ever. World events are once again reminding Americans that we must do more to produce our own energy.
Speaking to the Alaska State Legislature, Murkowski pointed out that Alaska's oil production is dropping as wells run dry. In fact, North Dakota could soon pump more oil than Alaska. The oil industry is also calling for more drilling. American refineries that turn oil into gasoline and diesel and heating oil want reliable sources of crude oil. Charles Drevna, who runs the National Petrochemical and Refiners Association, sees salvation close to home.
The way to do it is to look around in our own backyard and look around to our neighbors to the north in Canada and say, how can we somehow assure energy security?
Canada has huge reserves of oil trapped in oil sands, and Drevna says U.S. refineries are among the world's best at dealing with the crude that comes from these sands. Environmental groups object, however. Squeezing oil out of these sands uses a lot of energy and creates air and water pollution, and getting that oil to the biggest U.S. refineries will require a new and expensive pipeline. And there's oil, of course, in the Gulf of Mexico. After the BP oil spill last April, though, the White House stopped deepwater drilling there. This week, the Gulf is open again for deepwater business. Michael Bromwich, who runs the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement, says he is satisfied that it's safe to go back in the water.
The major difference between last April and today is that for the first time we are requiring that operators demonstrate in advance that they have a plan and the equipment necessary to respond effectively in the event of another blowout.
The drawback in all these cases, however, is that it'll take years to get much more oil flowing. Some experts say you've got to start sometime, but others, like Michael Lynch of Strategic Energy and Economic Research, say even though oil kingdoms may be unreliable, they still have to sell that oil.
Even the richest of them still worries about their unemployed youth, their long-term pension liabilities. Everybody needs money.
Especially governments that have nothing else to sell. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
The Environmental Protection Agency and global warming programs government-wide stand to lose big in the battle over the federal budget. The House already passed its bill to fund the federal government for the rest of this year. It doesn't just cut EPA programs. NPR's Elizabeth Shogren reports it also steamrolls Obama administration environmental policy.
The House bill would slash the EPA's budget by nearly a third, more than any other agency. It would stop the agency from regulating greenhouse gas emissions, and it would gut many other programs that prevent air and water pollution and enforce environmental laws. Representative Mike Simpson from Idaho heads the House subcommittee responsible for EPA's budget. He says he's only gotten a couple calls complaining about the cuts.
I've had substantial input from people on the other side that are concerned about the EPA and like what we're doing. They feel like we ought to rein them in some. They've gone far beyond their authority and, frankly, are costing jobs in this country.
Environmentalists say the public isn't complaining because few people have heard about the extent of the cuts. Groups like the Environmental Defense Fund are trying to spark an outcry with television ads. This one shows an ultrasound of a fetus. It quotes an American Academy of Pediatrics study warning about the risks of mercury exposure to young children.
The House sided with corporate lobbyists to block limits on mercury pollution. Did they think America wouldn't notice?
The ad is referring to new pollution standards for cement plants. An amendment added to the House bill would stop the agency from enforcing those standards. It was one of a cascade of amendments to block EPA initiatives, such as restoring the Chesapeake Bay and Florida Everglades and cleaning up coal ash waste and mountaintop coal mining. House Republicans also took aim at climate change programs across the government. Many new House Republicans deny what scientists widely accept, that climate change will have catastrophic consequences, and people are a significant cause of it. A new Republican member from Kansas, Mike Pompeo, led a drive to slash funding for an EPA program that makes businesses report their greenhouse gas pollution.
I can attest to you that this greenhouse gas registry will destroy jobs in Kansas. It will increase the cost of manufacturing for every Kansas airplane manufacturer, and it will increase the cost of energy for every Kansas family.
Some of the biggest EPA reductions would come in projects to update water treatment and sewage systems. Representative Donna Edwards is a Democrat from Maryland. She tried but failed to talk colleagues out of these cuts.
Just last month out in my district in a cold winter morning, not far from Capitol Hill, a 54-inch water main broke, created massive destruction, overturned cars, destroyed businesses, and left residents like me without safe drinking water for days.
Senate Democrats like Barbara Boxer from California say the House bill would hobble the EPA.
And it means dirty air, dirty water. It means more mercury in the air. It means more soot getting into our lungs. This is serious business.
Boxer says the Senate won't go for these cuts. She says House Republicans went way too far.
They have essentially unleashed war against the EPA, and in doing so, they are going to hurt the American people, and we have to stop it.
The battle over the EPA budget is one example of why it's so hard for Congress to agree on a plan to fund the federal government for the rest of the year. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
Some businessmen and scientists in Austin, Texas, are trying to change the way people think about plastic. They say it's not enough to buy a water bottle or sandwich bag that's free of BPA. That's the chemical consumer groups have criticized because, at least in animals, it acts like the hormone estrogen. These businessmen and scientists say BPA is only part of the problem. And as NPR's John Hamilton reports, they think they have a solution.
The solution involves a new approach to making plastic. Mike Yusey is the CEO of Plastipure. He says people need to stop focusing on BPA.
If you're concerned about BPA and you think that BPA-free is resolving the problem, then you should be aware that the majority, by and large, of these BPA-free products have high levels of estrogenic activity.
In other words, they release other chemicals that also mimic estrogen. Yusey's claim is more than marketing hype. This week, scientists from Plastipure and its sister company Certichem published a study of more than 450 plastic products, including many labeled BPA-free. It found that more than 90% released chemicals that mimic estrogen. And while it's still not clear if any of these chemicals harm people, a lot of consumers have shown they're willing to pay more to be extra cautious. Yusey hopes these people will take note of the new research.
The biggest challenge that we have is that we have solutions to problems that consumers are largely unaware of.
Those solutions were funded in part by more than $1 million in small business grants from the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation. The result? Baby bottles, water bottles, and all sorts of plastic items that don't release any estrogen-like chemicals. It all has to do with which raw materials you use and how you process them. Stuart Yaniger, a polymer expert at Plastipure, points to a machine that's extruding plastic into a thin film.
You can see we have pellets of the raw plastic resin. We have some pellets of colorant material.
Yaniger says even if these materials start out free of estrogen-like chemicals, they may not end up that way.
It's very important to actually test plastic that has been through a manufacturing process because things react chemically when you heat them, when you shear them, when they're exposed to oxygen.
And Yaniger says most plastic products contain a lot of different materials, any one of which may be a problem.
If we take a water bottle, for example, there's the bottle itself, there's the ink which is printed on the bottle, there are the antioxidants which are put into the bottle, you've got the lid, you've got colorants. By the time you're done, you might have 20, 30, 40 different materials in what looks like a very simple bottle.
Plastipure hopes to make money by showing manufacturers how to tweak each step in the manufacturing process, so there won't be any unwanted chemicals in the plastic bottles coming off the line. To find out whether a product measures up, manufacturers can hire Certachem, which has its lab in the same building. On one side of the room, a robotic arm is squirting liquid into glass vials. On the other side, Matthew Stoner is checking on some glass plates of human cells. The cells were exposed to various plastic products, then left to grow.
These are breast cancer cells, which have a defined response to estrogen signaling.
The cell mixture in each plate ranges from light blue to navy.
A darker blue means more cells, less blue means less cells, and we can then correlate this back to how much estrogenic activity was coming from the sample.
Already, the lab work has resulted in several products. Some came from R&D Molders, a nearby company that makes all kinds of stuff out of plastic. Fishing lures, medical containers, goose decoys, and now a very special water bottle. Greg Brown remembers when the folks from Plastipure showed up.
They came in and said, we want to make this particular bottle, and we want to make it out of this resin, and it looked like it was blow moldable, so it was no problem.
The bottles were easy to make, and tests showed they were free of estrogen-like chemicals. Now the trick is to find customers for those new bottles. George Bittner is the biologist from the University of Texas who founded both Plastipure and Certachem. He says if you make a better bottle, they will come, especially if they're concerned about health.
In this case, the solution to the potential health problem is very inexpensive.
The history of BPA supports Bittner's optimism about his own ventures. Just a few years ago, BPA-free products were rare. Now they're an important part of the plastics market. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Just over a month ago, the Department of Agriculture announced that it will allow American farmers to plant a genetically engineered kind of alfalfa. Organic food producers opposed the decision, some more fiercely than others. As Dan Charles reports, the news also sparked a debate among organic advocates about what's most important in the organic label.
Looking out over the rolling pastures of this farm near the Chesapeake Bay in eastern Maryland, the world of organic milk production seems peaceful.
From here, we can see everywhere we graze. See those posts on this side of that school bus?
Yeah.
That's the end of our pasture.
Dudley McHenry manages this farm for Horizon, one of the biggest organic milk producers in the country.
And then up here in this corner, those gates, that's actually the farthest point our milk cows will walk for pasture.
They will, at least in summertime, but it's February, so they're eating inside.
We feed corn silage, triticale, clover, alfalfa, ground corn, roasted soybeans.
But there's a tiny bit of something in the feed that these cows eat that's provoking a bitter division among people who all describe themselves as defenders of organic farming. The provocation is GMOs, genetically modified organisms. That's the popular term for plants with genes that were inserted in the laboratory. Organic farmers aren't allowed to plant GMO seeds, but most conventional corn in America is genetically modified, and corn, among all grains, is perhaps the most promiscuous cross-pollinator. So those genes often migrate into organic fields via windborne pollen that lands on the tassels of organic corn. As a result, grain traders say organic corn in the U.S. typically contains anywhere from 0.5% to 2% GMOs. It's been that way for the last 10 years or so. Now, does that matter? Maybe not. Tom Spohn, Horizon's director of dairy operations, says it doesn't keep Horizon from calling its milk organic.
We just make certain that we're meeting the letter of the organic regs to the T.
Those regulations say if a farmer plants non-GMO seed and uses organic methods, the harvest is organic, even if a few stray genes blow in. But in the past few years, antibiotic activists like Ronnie Cummins from the Organic Consumers Association have been calling on organic businesses to fight back against GMO contamination.
If you're not willing to sue the person who pollutes the organic crop and, you know, really undermines organic integrity, then we're not standing up for you, you know. It's like, you've got to do the right thing.
Cummins and other anti-GMO groups are aiming their attack at a crop called alfalfa because that's the GMO crop that the government approved most recently. Alfalfa is widely used as feed for horses and dairy cows. When this crop is grown for animal feed, it's actually much less likely to cross-pollinate than corn. But activists say even a little bit of contamination would be a disaster for organic dairy farmers, and that claim is echoed by some organic executives. Christine Bushway is executive director of the Organic Trade Association.
The threat to the alfalfa supply is very real, and the concern for our dairy producers is a huge one.
And Bushway even says if pollen from GMO alfalfa fertilizes alfalfa in organic hay fields,
you can't at that point sell it as organic.
This is a dangerous claim for the country's biggest organic trade association to make, because if that claim were true, if cross-pollination actually turned organic crops non-organic, there wouldn't be much organic corn left in the country. Charles Benbrook, chief scientist for the Organic Center, says this anti-GMO campaign is a risky thing for the organic industry. It could undermine the trust that more and more consumers have in organic food.
It would be a shame for the momentum behind the growth in the organic livestock industry to be siphoned off or diverted because of 0.1% contamination in a source of animal feed.
In fact, he says, if you insist on milk and eggs from animals that eat absolutely no GMO genes, you'll have to get that food from Europe.
And that's hardly a welcome solution for people that see in the organic food industry the best hope for positive change and innovation in the U.S. food system.
Some organic executives are worried that this infighting will lead to unrealistic demands by consumers. George Seaman, for instance, who's CEO of Organic Valley, one of the country's biggest organic food companies.
You know, there's reality and there's perception. And perception is consumers are saying they don't want any pollution in organic products. And whether that's realistic or not is another matter. But for sure, consumer perception is a real concern.
Seaman cited a survey in which 77% of organic consumers said they would stop buying organic food if it contained GMOs. Pamela Ronald, a plant biologist at the University of California, Davis, says those consumers are losing track of what's most important. Ronald has a foot on both sides of the biotech wars. She works with genetically engineered plants in the laboratory, and she's married to a longtime organic farmer. She and her husband together wrote the book Tomorrow's Table.
What's really important is, can we reduce use of insecticides? Can we foster soil fertility? Can we feed the poor and malnourished?
Those are the most important goals of organic farming, she says, and they're much more important than avoiding laboratory-spliced genes. For NPR News, I'm Dan Charles.
Another new technology that's shaping the modern world is GPS. It's turned the most navigationally impaired among us into experts in getting from point A to point B. But what if you're a newborn turtle and you don't have access to sophisticated mapping software? As NPR's Joe Palca reports, turtles, even hatchlings, don't need all that stuff to get where they're going.
Even before there was a global positioning satellite system, humans were pretty good at navigating the globe. A compass helps a lot.
But a compass doesn't really tell you where you are. You need a map.
Nathan Putman is at the University of North Carolina. Baby turtles can't read paper maps, but they do have a skill that helps them navigate. They can detect the Earth's magnetic field.
Turtles can use the magnetic field as a sort of map. It gives them positional information.
Here's how it works. There are two components of a magnetic field.
One is the intensity, or the strength of the field.
The stronger the field, the closer to the North Pole. But there's another property of magnetic fields. It's the field's inclination, the angle that the magnetic field lines intersect the Earth at. Huh? Trust me, it's just a property of magnetic fields turtles can detect. And using those two properties, a turtle
can get a good idea as to which side of the ocean it's on, not just whether it's in the northern or the southern part of it.
To demonstrate this, Putman and his colleagues collected hatchling loggerhead turtles.
We take an individual turtle and we place it in a circular, water-filled arena.
The arena is basically a water tank, 4 feet in diameter. Plenty of room for the inch-long hatchlings to swim around in. Then, Putman creates an artificial magnetic field around the tank.
And so we just change the magnetic field around the turtle to correspond to magnetic fields that exist along their migratory route.
Even though the turtles are in Florida, the magnetic field makes them feel as if they're elsewhere. For the study they report in the journal Current Biology, Putman simulates two magnetic environments, one in Puerto Rico and the other near the Cape Verde Islands off the coast of Africa.
The Cape Verde turtles, which are on the eastern side of the Atlantic, swam southwest. Near Puerto Rico, the turtles swam northeast.
There's a reason they swam in different directions.
What they're trying to do is to get into the North Atlantic Gyre, that big circle of water that encloses the Sargasso Sea.
James Gould is at Princeton University. He studies how animals navigate. He says you have to swim in different directions to get to the gyre depending on where you start out. And being able to head in the right direction is a critical skill for a hatchling turtle. The North Atlantic Gyre takes them to a place filled with a kind of seaweed called sargassum, where they can hide out until they're big enough to avoid predators. The hatchlings don't want to miss the gyre.
You do that and you lose your sargassum, you lose the places that you eat, you wind up in cold water, and you die, basically.
The stunning thing is that these turtles are born knowing the right way to go. Nathan Putman says scientists have known for a while that animals can detect latitude, how close they are to the pole. His new study shows they can detect longitude, how far east or west they are. And turtles aren't the only marine creatures that make long east-west journeys. Elephant seals do it, so do sharks and tuna.
It seems like those migrations would be really difficult to accomplish if you can't determine your longitudinal position.
Putman suspects that other animals use magnetic fields for navigation. Humans probably don't, hence the popularity of GPS systems. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
I'm sailing away, set an open course for the Virgin Sea.
That's all for this week's Science Podcast. You can find all the stories you heard today at npr.org/sciencepodcast. Send an email to sciencepodcast@npr.org to let us know what you'd like to hear. I'm Adam Cole. I hope you all find your way to a great weekend.